based on the relationship that we have between his country and our country. The honorable member is Mr. J. Am I pronouncing that correct? We welcome this as a committee, and the defense relating with the unions in your country. Also, we're intending to establish the military ombudsman in our country, or ombudsman. Now, we also would want to hear if does that really, is it working in your country? The integration of the military veterans is one of the areas that we are currently dealing with, and in general, the military discipline. Now, as a parliamentarian, you'd appreciate then that it is our responsibility as parliamentarians to do the oversight of the department, and also to, while respecting that sphere of government, but at the same time we have to do our oversight and cause them to be taken to account and to see things that do happen. Now, we want also to hear from your own experience and also how you then begin to strengthen this kind of relationship, but at the same time doing the effective oversight. But having said that, we do also understand that we have some relations with your country that deals with military matters internationally, in the participation in the peacekeeping, particularly you know what's happening in the African continent, particularly in Sudan. Also, I know that you also have a great interest on our World Cup 2010. And also, one last thing is I'm not sure about our members, whether we have members that are serving in the Interparliamentary Union, but we do know that our country is being represented. If you can just touch on that also as to how do we strengthen that kind of a relationship. Because as parliamentarians, as you would know, we have to share experiences to shape our world. With those few words of welcoming you, I want to then hand over to yourself and welcome you once again. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, dear colleagues, thanks for the warm welcome. It's a great pleasure for me to have a discussion today with you about some topics. I know there's not so much time, and you have a busy week here. So let me say, I came to South Africa to observe the common exercise Good Hope 3 between our forces, especially Navy and Air Force. And we are looking forward to the year 2010, not only for the World Cup, especially for the next exercise. Maybe that there will join us, the Army will join us also in that year. You're talking about something maybe when you're visiting our country. We are also in a transformation in our forces after reunification. Before reunification, we have more than 500,000 soldiers in the eastern and western part of Germany. Nowadays, we have only 250,000. You can see there's a big change with all the problems, what to do with the soldiers, their pension, they have to be paid. We have to organize new structures, especially for, the peacekeeping operations. German forces are one of the most included forces all over the world. You see, we are in Afghanistan with more than 3,000 soldiers nowadays. Maybe there will be more because it's really important for us to be there, especially to save our country. We have a big discussion in Germany, what to do, why are soldiers in Afghanistan, German soldiers. But we have a lack to explain it to our people. Only about, I think, 30-40% accept that German soldiers are overseas. But you see, we have many other countries where we are to help, especially in the area of the Balkans. There are more than 3,000 soldiers. All over, we have about 7,500 soldiers overseas or in other countries. Also in the African region, I remember the time when we were in the Congo with several soldiers for half a year, but then we go back to Germany. We are also with observers in Sudan, and I think we have to look forward, especially what will happen on your continent. Now, when we talked together before the meeting, I said that I'm sure that South Africa is a key for us to work together to help the people on this continent. If it is not possible to work together, we will have a lot of problems also in Europe. The European Union, it is a challenge for us. What happens with the people who come from the African continent? It's really a big problem. Most of them come to Spain or Italy. But we have to solve the problem together in the European Union and give help to your people here on the continent. And it seems to me that especially South Africa can help us to solve this problem because you are the key player on this continent. And I appreciate that we should strengthen our relationship, absolutely. And one step is to work together with the forces, and the exercise we did was running also until I think 2 weeks. It's a key story, and I hope that you visit Germany. You are talking about the ombudsman, the reserves, and all the things you must eat, because it works very well. It works very well. The ombudsman is an institution for the soldiers, and you can talk to him every time. Every soldier is allowed to do it, and the transformation in our army is really strong, and we need such an institution because the times, all the things change rapidly, and the soldiers they must have help. And especially if they come back, for example, we change our law, when they come back and they are hurt and in the foreign country, so that they can stay in the army, they get a normal job. Also, if they have lost a leg or something else, they are allowed now to stay in the army. In former times, it was not allowed. They have to retire. Nowadays, it's allowed that they can work on. And that's many points we have to have new regulations, but it works very well. But I say also it costs a lot of money, and our budget in Germany, normally we must have more money, especially when we're going overseas. But there is no hope. Here this year we got more than 1 billion euros more. We have about nearly 30 billion euros for the defense budget. But we have also the problem, I think the same story here, that the defense committee is not deciding alone what we are doing with the soldiers. The foreign affairs committee, and especially the budget committee, has a big influence for our work. That's my first statement. Hopefully, we can have a good discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman, Mr. President. Yeah. Yeah. Mr. Chairman,
my name is Mr. Chairman. I just want to thank my colleague from the chairman of Panama. This is Mr. Becker. Yeah. Elephant. Oh. I don't know what Becker comes. Maybe there's I think we need to also express appreciation. You see, as members of parliament here, we did discuss about sharing experience, about, you see, the unification of the East and the West. It's very important milestone in the East of Germany. So we will share the experiences as soon as we visit, but our other issues we can just to share. Then there is, you said how much is the budget? Oh, 30. 30. 30. 30. 30. 30. 30. 30. Okay, so in total we can transfer. Yeah, about 30. Yeah. So it's 11, I think, in euros, around 11. So it's a very huge amount, it's an enormous amount. And well, we've had, so obviously we are battling through, taking into consideration our responsibility. Germany, in terms of price, is not the same size as South Africa. It's far smaller. But in terms of responsibility, it's bigger. So I think it's important to have those interactions and exchanges such that you are in the position. And the other issue we're interested in as we go to Germany was the fact that they do have a COVID and triggering because of Germany. So there's a relationship in terms of trading and assisting each other is actually appreciated. So those are the issues I think we would, in an ongoing way, make sure that we are on board with each other, share the experiences so as we can, because we are new in this world. Thank you very much for that interaction on information.
Also, thank you to Mr. Hammer for his briefing for and family. Just one comment and one question. In a previous visit to Germany by the Defense Committee, we studied your system that you mentioned on the ombudsperson in Germany. We were very impressed by the way you operate such a system. As a matter of fact, we went so far to drop the Defense Committee in this country, drop this almost bill from this parliament. It's the first time it's ever happened that there's a draft bill on this person for the SAEDF. So we need to engage with you again and with ourselves about the ombudsperson, possibility of an ombudsperson based on your model and other experiences in the SAEDF. But this is just a comment. My question to you is, just to refresh my memory, the size of your reserve forces in Germany, and what do you do with the call-up of your reserves in terms of other, in operations other than war? How do you handle it? Is it embedded in an act of your parliament, or how do you handle it?
Yes, right.
Thank you, sir, and welcome, colleagues. I just want to find out your percentage, the expenditure of your defense in terms of your GDP. If you are aware that the UN is recommending that the particular percentage of your GDP must be able to spend, you know, not more than 5%. I want to check in your case, see how much right, you say you're spending out of your whole budget of your country. versus your own GDP? That's the first question. But then the other one I want to check also on is based on the question that my colleague raised. I want to find out, out of your reserve force, would you say it's constituting how much or what is your percentage of your defense force? For example, you'll find that other countries will say regular force will take 40%, and then reserve will go 60%, or vice versa. But I want to find out originally the reserve force. What is the percentage like out of your total defense force? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, Mr. Honorable Chairman mentioned that if they have 230,000 people in the force, in the defense force, and also mentioned that they are also now in the process of transformation. And my question to him is, what will the right size of the army be? Right side in the army, and also what is the major challenges they encounter in the process of transformation? And I think I will stick to that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Yes, the budget is that's really a problem also in Germany. You said, well, I told you that we spend nearly 30 billion euros a year for our defense budget. That's not enough. You know, we have a lot of projects coming through us because we need new weapons, we need new cars, protected cars, especially when we go overseas. You know, in former times, we had a lot of tanks, more than, I think, 5,000 tanks, big tanks, Leopard 1, Leopard 2. Nowadays, we have only 350, which are working now. That's all. Because after breaking down the wall in the eastern part, everything changed. So we have decided to buy other things. Especially, we give a lot of money for the ships because we see that we will go all around the world, especially by ships. We need more aircraft transportation. We bought a new fleet of aircraft, Airbus R400M. They will come to us in 2012, I hope. Looking forward for new aircraft like Eurofighter. It costs a lot of money. And so normally we must have more money for all the things. Our total budget in Germany is about 360 billion euros, nearly. So we have 9% for the defense budget. It's not enough. You see, if you want to join the NATO, normally you have to give more than 2% of your total income for the defense budget. So we have only 1.3%. So it's a big problem for us. Normally no one will accept us in the NATO if we want to join it now. But there is no more money in Germany because we are fighting every year for it. Hope that we will have enough money in the next year, especially, I told it, because we have to go overseas. That's it. To strengthen the common work, I think exercises like Route of Three will help us to understand each other. What's going on in our heads? If we are looking for solutions, when we're working together, maybe there will be a challenge on the Horn of Africa. We work together against fight against terrorism. What to do? Which strategy. We will take all the things are important, and I think especially when we're talking about your ships, you forget they were built in Germany, also submarines. I think it's also important for us that you buy these things in Germany. We have defense industry is also here in Cape Town during the exercise. I told yesterday, I talked to our admiral. He told me that you send some guys to help your people to repair the engines of all your things. And, it's only small steps, but I think it's very important to do that. Otherwise, if you are not able to use the things, you can't work with it. The ombudsman, it's in Germany, is called Bergeauftragter. He's in our is a part of our constitution. He's elected for 5 years, and he's free of any influence of the government. He had about 70, 80 people who were working for him. We have a lot of questions or letters to him, more than, I think, 6,000 a year, where soldiers ask for help, give information, and every single letter is checked if is it true, where are the problems. But he's also looking for other things, like the houses in the bases. You see, we built a lot of new military bases in the eastern part of Germany after reunification. We gave a lot of money to that area, and 3 years ago we decided to close them. But in the old part of Germany, there are the houses, the bases are so bad, so that we have to take a lot of money in our hands to build new houses, new infrastructure. For example, we are looking for an IT solution for the Bundeswehr, for our army, for forces. It will cost us more than 7 billion euros in the next, because the infrastructure for IT is rather bad in the army, but we hope that it will work. If you have a chance to come to Germany, Reinhold Vogel, our ombudsman, he will give you all the information you need. He's a really tough man, and also he's from the other party, but it doesn't matter, because in that position you are leaving the position of your party, and you are only there for the soldiers. There is reserve forces. We have a lot of them. Because they are organized after they retire in a more private way. Only sometimes 15% of the soldiers who are going overseas are reserve soldiers. That's very important for us. But most of them, they retire, and they are organized in an organization. We spend about 14 million euros a year for this reserve, so that they can have meetings and something else. We decide to do more for the reserve, but it's an up and down. You know, it belongs to the people who we have a general in that position who is responsibility for the reserve, and he said, "Oh, we don't need so much of them, And it was a mistake. The general isn't longer there. He had to retire. And it's very important for us to strengthen the reserve because there is a big knowledge they have got over the years, and we are using this knowledge, especially in our work overseas. Yeah, 250,000 people. I think in Germany it's enough. It's enough. Yeah, we have a conscription, military conscription. Young men, only men, have to serve for 9 months now. But not all the young boys have to go to the army. We have 80% of all the young men in Germany have to go to the army or have to serve in another way. If they don't want to wear guns, they can do social work for 9 months, and then they are free. You know, we are talking about a professional army, but I think we need the conscription, especially in the point of view that nearly 50% of our soldiers who are for a longer time in our army come from this people, from this group. We have the possibility normally you have to be there 9 months, but if you want, you can stay in the army for 23 months, and then you can leave the army. You earn much more money, and they are also allowed to go overseas. Normal soldier to do the work only for 9 months, they are not allowed to go overseas. They have to stay in Germany. They have to stay in Germany. And that's why we need the conscription as well as in the years before. I think to have a professional army, it's not cheaper. It's much, much more expensive, especially in Germany, I think. So my direction will say no professional army in all over, but we have to it's much sure that the soldiers earn enough money. That's a big problem also, to get higher rank, especially when I see that they go overseas, when they go to Afghanistan or something. It's really quite hard job.
Mr. Korenhoff, and I will take Dr. Korenhoff, Dr. Schumann. You'll ask your question, and you also do the honor to thank Mr. Hellman, because he was supposed to be in another meeting at 10 o'clock, I'm told. But we do appreciate that he has stayed a bit longer with us. Dr. Korenhoff.
Thank you. Mr. Herman, my question would relate to the percentage that your defense force is receiving from your budget. Has it remained more or less the same, consistent, or has it declined? And to what extent has it declined? Why I'm asking this question is also with the change in the whole political construction. Would you say that the focus of your defense force has changed from one who preserves your territorial integrity to one of peacekeeping, more focused to be deployed to hotspots, wherever that might be? And do you see this as a continuing tendency? Because in a certain extent, while I'm asking this question, it also applies to us with an increased peacekeeping role within the continent and elsewhere. Okay.
In Germany, it is not allowed to bring the armed forces against terrorism. For example, it's strictly looking back to our history, it's separate. Police forces have to do have to fight against organized crime, have all to do the same. The only way to bring the soldiers in a position where they work in our country is to defend our country, our border, and especially after what 1960, to help by natural catastrophes. We have a big flood in Hamburg, and then we changed our constitution. Otherwise, it is not allowed that the armed forces can work in our country. Sometimes it can. Police, for example, can ask for help if, for example, when they need looking for a person in the forest, you can use the tornado with a camera. So we can ask for help, but there the Minister of Defense had to decide that it's okay. Otherwise, they are not allowed to work in Germany. The budget is growing in the last years. Last year, we have a little bit more, nearly 1 billion euro more. It will raise up in the next years, but from former times, before reunification, we have more than 30%. Or nearly 30% of our whole budget for defense. But times changed, and after reunification, there was a transformation of our forces, and we decided to give you an example. Before, with our tanks, we don't need so much tanks because our enemy in former times it was only one way; they came from the east. Now we have a new challenge with the international terrorism, and we say in Germany, we say we defend our country also in Afghanistan, because it is better to fight against terrorism in the other country where it grows up than it comes to Germany. Okay, we have really a problem to tell that to our people. What are our interests? That is a big challenge for us to tell it to them, but I hope that it will work. But because it's very important, we have a big discussion, and the decision wasn't so easy for the members of parliament to send our soldiers to Africa, to the Congo. There was a big discussion, but I think it's necessary that we do it, and. That's the way it works, especially of the position of Germany. International, we are invested now after reunification. We are, I think, a global player, and so we have to fulfill our task all over the world. And I think because we're talking about what to do in future. I think the German forces will go all over the world for peacekeeping missions, to help the people all over the world. But, with our 7,000, and that's the problem, by 250,000 soldiers in all, overall. It's a problem to send more soldiers overseas. We say that we need, for one soldier who is overseas, we need five soldiers in our country for support, logistics, and so on. That's a big challenge for us, especially, we are going to Africa. The climate is much more different to Europe. We need different engines, and so on, and so on. It's a big challenge for us, but we are ready to do it.
Thank you, Chairman. Chairman, I think I would express on behalf of our committee that a profound feeling of gratitude towards you for being here, gracing us with your presence today, and informing us of the situation in Germany. And also, I think from the questions, highlighting the many similarities between what you are doing and have done with the reunification of Germany and what has happened in this country. And also your very presence here in a time where we've had the exercise Good Hope, where the German Navy has been involved, as further an indication of the goodwill that we're experiencing. And also for the way you were able to convey your message, which, like many of us, English isn't our first language, and I think you did it exceedingly well. In your introduction, you said that the interest of seeing political stability in Africa is also in the interest of Europe. And it is so. The world has become smaller. Globalization, if we like it or not, is a fact. And the presence of a defense force is there to create stability within a country. And if Africa shouldn't become prosperous and be able to look after its own people, there are consequences in other countries. And I think that the political will to create the environment where there is a distribution of wealth, where the people who are poor can also uplift themselves, goes hand in hand to where stability is also managed by the presence of soldiers and so on. So we must never lose sort of sight of that essential balance which we need in the world. But thank you once again. Convey our good wishes to all your colleagues in the Bundestag. And if everything goes according to plan and the good Lord looks after us, we might have the privilege of seeing you soon in your own country, and we look forward to that. Thank you very much.
I say it again, thanks for the warm welcome and giving me the floor. I really hope that we will see us soon in Germany. Have a really big discussion about all the issues of your interests and our interests, because we have to talk together. We have to talk together, not in one way, we have common aims, and it's important for us, really, that you visit us in Germany. Hope the budget will be there, that you come to Germany, because it's really important for us. And I hope maybe we will have an exercise, Good Hope 5, in Germany with your army. Maybe it will work, but also in 2010, I hope to see you on our ships in the harbor. I'm sure I will be back, because I'm very interested on your country, on your politics, and what will happen in future. Thanks for all, and that you give me the time.
Thank you, Mr. Herrmann, and enjoy your stay in the country. As we are ushering out Mr. Herrmann, I'll give 2 minutes break, and we'll reconvene immediately after. Thanks again. That we had. I did ask one of our members, as far as I know, about the Good Hope thing. And a member was just in the dark. This is one thing that has been time and again indicating to the department that they must time and again brief us on all the activities that are happening there. We have studied members that also. That it wants to begin to reflect that there is no, something that's very guided, there is no coordination of activities within our department. Now I'm talking about the land wars, I'm talking about the Navy and the like. It really gives a little bit of a concern. Because this is captured in the media and you find that very little being known. We have also spoken about this, I think, last week. About the accommodation of men. It's a national issue whereby we have to profile our army on such activities, but this is not happening. Then it once again reflects on the department. Members have spoken also on many other things that were raised, which are quite of interest, that the committee might also look into. The Dr. Joseph Gordon said it quite clearly that we as a committee, we came up with a bill that released the ombudsman. The big question is, how far did that go? How far did that go? Because the bill was orchestrated by the committee. And the bill is nowhere to be seen. We have only 4 bills for the year that we directly deal with, but it is not appearing. It's one area that we should begin to make a follow-up on that, because it's critically important. Some interesting issues that you raise, the defense industry, the IT improvement, talk much about the reserve forces, defense budget, 2% NATO contribution, the military conscription. This is on the the military conscription. Very little do we say about this. I think some issues that the committee must begin to engage in. I'm deliberately on this. I know we have our own positions, but revisiting this. Really, I think this particular issue is quite of an interest. I was talking to Dr. Schumann, reminding me that the late Chris Harris was in favor in a way. but let's look into our country, what is happening today, without that form of thing. Whether we were seeing it as negative, I'm talking as a chairperson, not as a chairperson, but as a chairperson. So they say, looking at what is actually happening, we're talking about the military discipline. We're talking about the National Youth Service. The National Youth Service is coming from the Department of Public Works. So they say, we have to begin to instill the military discipline in that particular program. Why didn't we, as defense, come up with a given program to then the question of crime within the country. What contributes to that if there's no military discipline? You know, there are many things that are happening, you know, that are the big issues that we can be talking about the racism in the University of Free State. Had we had some form of military discipline since from 1994, I don't think such things would be happening. We are talking about the integration and strengthening of the relationships whereby we have to begin to understand. Do we have in the department that kind of a concept to then say, how do we then begin to contribute to the country to address the very key problem that we're confronted with, the question of crime? If you also address the question of race at the end of the day, what can we then begin to do? To then say, how can we then being as a country? Because there's one unit that's being respected all over, even in the country, the army. That then we also touch on the issue of the union. Because if things begin to fall apart, then we're going to be confronted with major challenges like the issue of racism that begins to crop up. And we have to begin to control that kind of anger that we must spill over because we're beginning to point fingers as a country. Do you really have to do that? It's a painful thing that happens. But we have to own up, all of us, rather than beginning to point fingers. But I'm then saying, what is our army? When such things do happen, there must be some kind of a think tank within the army to then say, how do we then shape things around? And what contribution can we then begin to make as an army? You know, I was asking the very same question in another program that the Deputy President came up with. You asked Jesus and Jesus. And then to say, how much did we then input as this particular unit because we have this goal? And if that is the case, and we're talking about the exodus that is happening, the drainage of the such skills moving away, then what do we do? Because as we begin to address that, frank engagement with yourself is so critical and important with ourselves to then say this is the kind of program that we want you as members of parliament to begin to support because we're coming up with this kind of an approach. I might as well be talking to the wrong people here, but I'm then saying this is something that comes up immediately when you then begin to see how other countries are shaping themselves. And also we have this international scale of crime, terrorism and all that. We have to be more broader in our way of thinking rather than to think within certain confines. We have to be more broader. This is one thing I'm then saying, members, is one key area that we have to look into. That is the question of the conscription. I'm hearing that they are, for them it's 9 months, and they are confined within the country, those who undertook that 9-month training. And then it does extend to the training 3 months. It also touches now to the question of socioeconomic benefits of the army. We know that we also have the same challenge. But as I say, these are some key areas that the committee has to begin to look into and delve into. I'm showing this to you, by the way, so that you can also get the input from your side.
I think we indeed need to call, like all other nations, even in the first you walk about, there's a time when you say, but let me check my compass. Am I still on the direction that I intended to? Because you might find that you said you're going to northeast, only to find that you are now moving to northwest. So I know it's one skill to be able to read the compass was used to give me a headache. But, you know, I'll just cite this example. I was, this weekend was very far somewhere in Limpopo, the villages, you know, inside, people are fighting inside. I met on my way out, because, you know, on our way out, I met youngsters of about, most of them were about 19, 21, they're about 9. German, over here. They are here on the they are finished with their specialists. They are just doing some courses, other than on education, health, and all that. Now, one thing that I remarked was when I was talking to them and the other, this is just their stuff. none of them had children. All themselves, they are on their own out there. Now, I looked at it also with my hindsight, you know, but at home, is it possible to take the young people out there because they're already here for 6 months and they're still going to drag another 6 months? They're studying that community, different things. Now, you know, there's also a particular discipline that as a person you learn. For us, we need to open this situation to say, what do we learn? Where do you want to drive the energy of young people? We have been there, we have been energy. Some of us, we joined, you know, other movements. At the time, our parents were not aware that we actually members of those organizations. But we had energy. We are not even absconding at school. We are doing our work. That's not like a normal time. Yet we are doing this, but we also then got the discipline and perseverance, you know, soldiering, doing that thing. And today we are, I would say, we might not be the best, but we are able to play a constructive role in society. Now, as to what you must be able to separate is a post, is pre-liberation and post-liberation. These situations are different. We can't be looking at them with the same eyes. There have been other seminars, and I heard it from the senior, such a senior staff council workshop, members of the SNCF, here. And in that workshop, they were here, the senior staff called. They were here, led, I think, of Kenner, the original Kit Mukwad. One of the things they impressed on us, you know, they're talking, they're asking us, let's say, but why are we abandoning this? Now, what I find is that everyone seems to be pointing and saying, but why? No one is saying, no, can we convene and talk about this issue and see to what extent we agree and to what extent we differ? So that out of that, we can then be able, I'm sure, to come up with something. So I am just making my input on that. Thank you.
Military conscription. I think we, the country did come up with a moratorium on the conscription, military. It was called a compulsory military conscription because of what instructions and intentions tried the new dispensation. What we are talking about today is national service. We need them for the issues around the initiative coming through and national youth. So anywhere in the world, everyone is saying you can't get any discipline, which is far from the discipline of the defense. That's another issue that we should. So what we need to do is that when we grew up, we used to be I was a Boy Scout when I grew up, and there were the girls used to say there were girl guides. Yeah. So in any normal upbringing of the country and youth, we should inculcate everything. So South Africa is trying to maneuver out of a situation, out of a wet scenario situation, which was brought about by apartheid. And in our point of reaction to apartheid, we threw away everything which apartheid did. And sometimes I'm not apologetic. There are certain good things which apartheid brought. And unfortunately, we never had an opportunity of crossing and reviewing. So maybe at some point we shall have an opportunity to do that. Such that you don't necessarily militarize the whole nation. In Cuba it's different. The whole nation is militarized, especially because of the Cold War scenario. So it's different. But in South Africa, the attempt to inculcate the discipline in the nation may not necessarily mean militarization. accident in the corporate way, all management turnaround strategy of military origins, anywhere in the world, corporate. Successful managers and directors derive their discipline from military discipline. See? And when you move away from that, it means we introduce threat phenomena, which phenomena will be a problem for the corporate strategy of the country. So that is why I'm saying we will revisit the discussion and make sure that we look into this issue through another eye, not be influenced by what our public was doing to the people of our country.
I think that really opens up that to me when we open up the issue and discuss it. And our research has done a lot of scientists beginning also to work on that. And so that when we do meet, we have to schedule that. And we have to schedule that and then look into it properly. Remember, having said that, then let me thank you for your comments. And also thank you for your input when another man was here. The business before us are two goods that met the deadline. They were tabled on Friday on the 29th. Your cabinet and the defense are many important. They're supposed to be taped today. They're supposed to be taped today. And with the careful, the committee was intending to deal with that one on or before the end of the month and then before the House. We've targeted the 26th for the debate, if that will be possible. I'm saying this because it's just a question of transferring from one department to the other. That is all. But one question that came from the committee when they were looking into the draft, even let me start by saying, it's going to assist us to get the draft even well before it is tabled. Because as members, we want to engage with the department even earlier in time rather than to come and discuss and debate it when it has been formally tabled before the House. I might as well say that it's only, I think, at the end of last week when we went to talk to the live in person to try to get at least the draft just to be able just to prepare them, because the members want to prepare for such meetings so that they can be business-minded rather than to come across the bill when we are to be breached by the department. We need them to have a confidence. There is no harm at all to have a draft while the department is still working on it. Because we won't also be dealing with it formally. We'll be dealing with the bill informally so that we can be able to work together. I'm raising this issue because this is the question that has come at the tail end. It's to ask, because we are trying to push that it must be passed before the end of the month as an indicator. What transitional arrangements have been made between our department and the Department of Arts and Culture in receiving? What processes have been put in place? Because in the event that we pass the bill, is it going to end up hanging in the limbo? Waiting somebody to grab it when we do not know. So if you can get that kind of clarity, because that's the only area that is going to delay subcommittee to have it passed before the end of this month. Whereas we've made a commitment to Parliament that we can't finish it because the schedule is, because there's this kind of pressure that has to push this bill through. But if there is that kind of an arrangement, that is going to comfort the committee because we cannot pass it through if there is no recipient from the other side, such as the Department of Agriculture arrangement made. Having said those few words, I want to welcome you and the department, and we will then request that you take us through. We'll be starting with the council, as it were. I might as well also add up to them saying the committee has come up with a report on this annual report. That's going to be a simple process also, as we have tabled in the house. And they will be making some recommendations so that when the department on the other side takes over, that those recommendations, they move with them, with that. Over to you, we'll have you introduce yourself and then take us through.
Thank you, the Honorable Chairperson and members, Honorable members of the Portfolio Committee on Defense. I am Major General Mona from the Department of Defense, Acting Chief Defense Legal Services. We are here because we are requested by this Honorable Committee to brief the Committee on the proposed amendments to the Defense Act as well as the Casual Management Repeal Bill, as the Honorable Chairperson has already indicated. With regard to the proposal on the Amendment to the Defense Act, will deal with the issue of IG, Inspector General, Provision Section 55, and Reserve Force. We'll also deal with Customer Management Repair Bill. I'm accompanied by my colleagues, Chief Defense Reserve Major General Anderson, also accompanied by Admiral Retired Burkhardt from the Reserve Force Council, as provided for in Section 48 of the Defense Act that deals with the Reserve Force issues, representing the Reserve Force Council. I'm also accompanied by Brigadier General Sucha, who is from the Inspector General Environment, Director Anti-Corruption and Anti-Fraud. I'm also accompanied by Director Legal Advice, Mr. Njitena, from the DOD. We also have Lieutenant General Conradi, SO1 Reserve from the Western Cape. Also in our midst, we have a representative from the State Law Advisor who has been engaging with him on this bill to get them certified in order to meet the target date and so forth. Honorable Chairperson, I've taken note of the concerns raised by this House. When we go back to the department, we will brief them on these issues. There are valid issues that we have raised, and surely the department will respond. Let me invite us to engage you on those important issues that we have raised. Without much ado, I will request Mr. Njikela to take us through the presentation regarding the presentation of Customs Management Repeal Bill, and thereafter deal with the proposed amendments to the Defense Act. We have other role members here who will comment with regard to policy issues from the environment, like Inspector General, Reserve Force, and so forth.
Thank you very much, Chair. As you indicated, Chair, I don't know whether I should begin by dealing with the comments you just made with regard to the issue of the handing over of the council, or should just go back as to what informed the process we're trying to create here. Chair, you will remember that the council is part of the Defense Endowment Property Act. It's one of those defense endowment properties that they handed over back in the day. Now, if you look at the Council Management Act of 1993, it imposes certain obligations on the Minister of Defense with regard to the management and administration of the castle in particular. There are other properties, but they are not necessarily linked to this one. In the bill, we deal specifically with the management of the castle. Now, one of the obligations that are placed on the Minister of Defense in terms of that act is the issue of protection of cultural heritage. Now, the view that the department took, I think back in 2003 already, Well, that the Department of Defense, as an institution, is not properly structured to execute some of these mandates, as imposed by the Cargo Management Act. Now, one view that was taken at the time was that since in the new dispensation we have a specific ministry that deals with cultural issues and issues of art, the idea should be that the issue of management and administration of the cargo should vest with that responsible ministry, and that the Department of Defense does not have either the skill or the structure to deal with this issue. And I think Chair has already referred to the issues of auditor support and all those things. I'm sure the committee will be aware with regard to the qualification with regard to this issue. So a decision was taken at a point in time that there has to be this engagement with the Department of Arts and Culture to facilitate the whole process of the transfer of the management and administration of the council to that department. And a number of discussions have taken place at the ministerial level and both at an official level. But then informed by that decision at the ministerial level, we initiated the process at an official level to say, how can we give effect to the ministerial decision to transfer the cargo, the management of the cargo to the Department of Arts and Culture? So the process, the level where we are here is really a culmination of that consultation between us and the Department of Arts and Culture. I can assure you that throughout this process, the Department of Arts and Culture has been in contact with the Department of Defense. And in fact, even the CAD memo that stands before the cabinet was jointly tabled by both the Minister of Defense and the Minister of Arts and Culture. So there is a whole process. We have actually established a joint task team between the Department of Defense and the Department of Arts and Culture to deal exactly with the issues of the transfer in as far as it relates to the assets and the liabilities of the council. So there is already a joint working relationship. It's very unfortunate that due to the short notice, the legal advisor from the Department of Arts and Culture was not able to join us today. So Chair, coming from that, then we have to find a way as to how do we facilitate this transfer. We consider two options. Your normal option, Chair, your ideal option will be to do a transfer in terms of the Constitution where the President, by means of a proclamation, simply transfers the functions imposed in terms of the Cargo Management Act on the Minister of Defense to the Minister of Arts and Culture. But that will not solve the issue of the Act itself, because the Department of Arts and Culture has its own regulatory framework, which is the Cultural Institutions Act. Now, their view was that it is not necessary because they wouldn't be interested in taking over the responsibilities under the Cultural Management Act. The alternative they suggested was that rather than transfer and burden them with the Act, which in their view has no purpose in the new dispensation, the best route to go, which we agreed with, was that the Cargo Management Act should be repealed in its entirety. Now, what it means then, say, it comes to the concern you raised, that if you repeal this Act, what do you have in place? Because you can't just pass a bill and then again, we have to wait for another 2 years for them to set something in place. Now, under the Cultural Institutions Act, there is a provision for the Minister of Arts and Culture to declare institutions as cultural institutions. And once he has done that, then it means he must set up a council or allocate that function to the existing council, which will then assume the responsibility of managing and administration. So the reason we're working together closely is because we want to make sure that when the bill gets passed, the Department of Arts and Culture is also at a stage where it can declare the council as a cultural institution, and immediately the council that exists under the AIX take over the responsibility. Now, what we propose to do, Chair, there is a council that already exists in terms of the Cultural Institutions Act. But an opinion has been expressed that the Minister of Arts and Culture will prefer a separate council for the council. Now, they are establishing a council under the Public Finance Management Act, Section 3A Public Entity. And I've been assured by the Department of Arts and Culture that they are working towards the deadline of the 1st of April when the new financial year kicks in. So they are at an advanced stage, and unfortunately he's not here to confirm that. But that has been the arrangement between us. Now, with regard to the issue of assets and liabilities, like I indicated, Chair, there is already a joint task team that looks at what are the assets that fall under the council, what are the liabilities that are there, what will be the financial implications of the Department of Arts and Culture taking those things, taking into account the issue of liability. There is a transitional issue again of the employees that are currently working Now you will remember that the council is constituted as a military component, that is uniformed members who will remain with the Department of Defense even after the crusade. Then there is a civilian component, members who are now working and being paid by the council control board themselves. Now what we propose to do in respect of that, the members that are already employed by the council control board, in other words, that are on the payroll of the council control board, will be transferred with the council to the Department of Agriculture in terms of Section 197 of the Labor Relations Act. And they will continue as employees of the new council that will assume the responsibility once they have been transferred. So I think that deals largely with the issue of the transitional provision. Of course, Chair, the relevant question you raised was whether all of this will be able to happen at the same time, because that's what is critical. It is difficult for me to say yes at this stage, but that's the assurance that we have that the public entity is already with the Department of Finance, that the National Treasury, for the establishment of that. So up to now, I have no indication that there has been a lack in the establishment of that council. So I think what I could indicate to you that process is unfolding, and we're hoping that by the 1st of April, there will be a council that will immediately assume the responsibility, assuming, of course, that this process of the legislative amendment will have been finalized by then. So, Chair, the ultimate effect of this whole thing will be now the repeal completely of the Council Management Act. It will cease to exist from the 1st of April if we meet the deadlines as I indicated. But all the employees will move and will be managed now by the council, the new council established under the Agriculture Council, not by the Council Control Board, as it was initially the situation. So I think that is basically the essence of the proposal in nature. But even after all of this has happened, Chair, the council will remain a defense endowment property under the defense endowment property of 1922. But this is about the management and the administration, which in the view of the Department of Defense is the responsibility of the Minister of Agriculture, not the Department of Defense. That's where the skill lies, Chair. So I think in essence, Chair, that is the proposal that we're making to the committee. And so that was approved by cabinet, by from both the Minister of Agriculture and the Minister of Defense. I don't know if General Mono would like to add anything on that, Chair. But from my side, I think that's the principle.
Thank you, Chairperson. Indeed, I would like to reiterate what Mr. Jigalas indicated. It is the intention of the Department to expedite this matter, and we'll do everything in our power from the Department of Defense to ensure that smooth transition takes place. And also pursue the legal aspect of it so that it's finalized from the legal point. Thank you, sir.
I'm starting with Dr. Koranov, Honorable Benji, and Mr. Tigger.
Thank you, Chief. First of all, thank you for the presentation. I think it's clear, and I don't think anybody in this committee would have a problem with the concept that you put on the table for the transfer. It's long and offering, and I think we should be welcome. The appeal of the Council Management Act, I think we will support that. Just a few, thank you for clarifying the property. It will remain a defense endowment property. So that was my first question, but thanks for that. Currently, the DOD have usage of parts of the castle. What will happen to the usage of the DOD? I believe there are certain units that is utilizing the castle. What will happen to the usage of by the DOD of certain portions of the castle? Secondly, the AG came out with a report. It was not a qualification, but it was a serious emphasis of matter. So, how are you going to handle that between the DOD and the Department of Government? One of the emphasis of matter, there were many, but the main emphasis of matter were that they violated the ONAM, the Castle Control Board. They did not adhere to the PFMA. And secondly, with a serious question on asset management. If I remember, those were the three main issues in the Auditor General's report. So in the handing over from one government department to the other, how are you going to handle and solve the issues raised by the Auditor General? And then the following question is whether the Auditor General, and I'm sorry that the Department of Agriculture is not here, but will that new council also be audited by the Auditor General? Because in the planning, but if it's not, then I have a serious problem with it. Because what happens with the current report, with the Auditor General raises the issues, then it just dissolves, and nobody's going to pay any attention to it, least of all Parliament. I'm very disappointed that the Department of Arts and Culture representatives are not here, because this is a very sensitive matter over process, and I don't think I think it's incomplete if the two departments are not briefing Parliament together on this handing over process, because that handing over process is going to be critical against the background, as what you mentioned earlier, is the protection of cultural heritage. And that handing over process should be seen. And I'm not sure how you're going to handle it if one department is not here to discuss with us. And that also, well, the deadline of 1 April, that's less than 30 days. You know, how I can't ask the question to the DOP, but I would like to ask the question to DAC. How practical is it? With less than 30 days, you have a complete establishment of a separate council. We don't know who's going to sit on it, who's going to serve it. Will it be continuity? Is it totally new people coming in? We're flying blind. So I would have preferred the Department of Arts and Culture to be as informed about what is this. There's an expert council currently, knowing exactly for the last, since 1993, what happened with the assets, the management, and things like that. All of a sudden, within less than 30 days, we're going to have a completely new council. Are we going to have continuity? What are the issues? How are they going to manage it? I can't expect the DOE to answer the question, but I think it's still a question that I might. Thank you.
No, thanks, Professor. I think I'm on the same issue that the comments the Honorable Makwara office raised. State commands the very strength and strength. So, transformation is one transformation. As an example, today when you're going to the different environments, you find they've used a name like Copa for one of the equipment that they use for fire. They also use other African names to refer to the platform because they're changing it. The platform can change it today. I believe it's also part of the staff of the council that is supposed to be looking at some of the platforms. Now, yes, I'm not looking at, I might be missing the other things like the political brief. But what I want to find out is the Auditor General has placed matters of emphasis on the management of the institution. There are aspects there that they recommend to the Foreign Office and the Election. Now my problem, or my question is rather, changing or transferring or repealing, how does it stop you from getting? And I'm raising it with another matter, it's a matter of urgency now on my side. Because what it means, I'm looking at, it's not a question of honorable, what's called the state, it's not a question of you emphasizing that no, the other department knows and is known. There's no one who doubts that. But then we're talking of a legislative process matter that takes place. Where are these other people? Tomorrow, the issue is, you know, the others, this was left out, we saw so-and-so has done it. Is it not really a prerogative that the other Department of Agriculture should have been here? So that this very matter that I'm asking, because the transformation of it, I appreciate it, but I'm saying, to what extent is that's going to be removing matters of emphasis and concern that were raised by the issue in the next budget. Because that's what my question is about. Changing names to this department, that can be done, but that still doesn't, and I don't want that to be used as a reason now when the other cannot account to come next year, end of the year. You say, you know, this thing, the engine was not properly done, and, you know, more than one of the things finished to the committee. So, Chairperson, through you, I'm actually holding strictly according to that law. I think the two parts, the two departments must be here, and they must talk to the committee and answer the question. What to me is fundamental. We can't be what you call assisting people. As, you see, you are bringing an element of civilian here, members of the other class, who are going to be part of this new thing. To what extent are they ready? Because part of it, like you are saying, yes, there is this component that you don't necessarily be doing away with your military people. They can be transferred. But once you also now start bringing the two staff, you see, also the issue of commanding, so some of those people don't be men. And you know, the PFMA people are managed like this, and the ministry of people are managed also differently. How is that going to feel? All in all, what I'm interested in is to make sure that come next round, we don't have the matters which the auditors want attention of the committee to.
Thank you, Dr.
I simply, maybe out of ignorance, try to check. Maybe these are legal technicalities which I don't know, because I see that this is an act within an act to repeal an act, and it becomes another act. To repeal an act, it becomes another act. No possibility. Maybe you'll explain this to me.
And because of that legal technicality and complication, what is the committee expected to do with this?
Repeal this act, which we are going to repeal. What is the role of the committee going to be towards that process?
Talking about the council, the council. The Council of Budo
is the one who came down.
The only council we have. And it's a cultural institution. How different it is from a heritage institution, let's say. Because if you have to refuse a culture because of an accident, there are museums which belongs historically to the Defense Force in around Johannesburg and elsewhere in the country. If the Department of Agriculture thinks that they fall under their jurisdiction, are going to do that with any other institution which has heritage and cultural origin. So I'm just saying that those are questions which so ignorant on my part, but I need some clarity and explanation. So I think we should be in a position to get into that.
I think the question that is being posed in that moment, it goes back to then say, what was the motivating factor? Those responsibilities. You spoke about the administrative and the management. Yes, you gave your input regarding that. Could it be then that being deliberate is my question? Could it be then that the DOD was failing on this part? And this is then when we then decided to then let's do away with this thing. What are the factors that you have? to say to you are just too short of being qualified. Well, why? Well, why are we really doing it? Are we going to the DOD? What is really failing to earn and manage? What informs? Yes, there's a cabinet about the very that is if you can get the cabinet level that informs. That is that should then happen because it also helps because I normally do that that we have to get a better direction when that matter was discussed and decided by cabinet so that we also look into that. If we can get that it will further action. But a number of them are questions if I may have a few.
Thank you. Chairperson, honourable member, the questions raised are quite valid, and indeed I will strongly support the request made by Honourable Julie that we need to have both departments here, so that tomorrow there shouldn't be an issue that this was not properly handed to us and so forth. And I would also like to acknowledge from the department side, DOD, that the relevant role players in the task team from the chief law environment, who is also involved in the task team, and also the personnel from the CFO dealing with this issue of qualification, because there's a strategy how the department is going to deal with this issue of qualifications and so forth. They are not here present today, and if indeed it will be possible for the interstate to engage both departments, I will make sure that those members are here to lay the fears of the committee how this issue of qualification will be addressed so that you don't just transfer problems to Department of Arts and Culture. What is the strategy of the DOD? With regard to these questions, I will give Jim Sanchez just to respond to that, if you can.
Thank you, Chair. I think the first question was with regard to the usage of castles by DOD. I think it is exactly for that reason, Chair, that when I was concluding, I went back to the Defense Endowment Property Act. But the castle will remain the Defense Endowment Property Act. Now, if you look at that act, it specifically tells you what was the purpose of the handover of this land to the defense. One of those was the use by the military. So that will not change. Some of the offices will remain there. But as to what offices or who will remain there is a matter that will be determined. It's one of the practical issues that are being dealt with at the level of the Joint Task Team. Unfortunately, Chair, like I indicated, we only received the request to be here on Friday afternoon. So it was a bit of a challenge to even gather the team that we had. Like General Mono indicated, and perhaps it will benefit the committee that if we are given another time where the CFO will be here to deal with the issues of the quality, of the emphasis of the matter. People from the logistics will be able to deal with the issues of the practicalities of the transfer. And possibly, of course, it is the people from the Department of Arts and Culture should have been here. Perhaps that's for your invitation, Chair. So but the issue of usage, the defense force will remain in some of those places. But as to what aspect or what area of the castle we will utilize, the issue that has to be jointly decided at the level of that task is one of the issues that are being looked at by the task to make sure what portions you would like to retain and use for your own purposes, and what purposes will be occupied by the Department of Arts and Culture. But unfortunately, I can't give you the details of those areas because no determination has been made in advance. I think the second issue related to the issues of violations by the Castle Control Board and the lack of compliance with the PFMA. Chair, when I began my presentation, I indicated that indeed the issue of the inability of the Department of Defense to deal with this issue is one of the motivations for this transfer. But the concern was that we don't have the expertise to deal with issues of cultural institutions. And there's a department that has the expertise and the people to deal with this kind of issue. So it made sense at the time that this department, with the skill that it has, it assumes this responsibility under this. So I think that is a very practical part of the proposal itself.
If you have a department that is positioned to do this thing better than we can, that department should be able to assume that responsibility. And I think even if you look at the role of the various ministers, it seems to me that it is very appropriate that this thing be located within that department. And I think the issue of skills and expertise will come in handy to deal with some of these issues. But like I indicated again, that the whole issue of the transition itself, if now you look at what we propose in clause 2 of this bill, which is an issue again which touches on the issue whether the 1st of April is really or realistic when we look at it. In clause 2, we make a proposal despite all the attempts, because at all this time we have always had it at the back of our minds, but the issue of the transfer and the establishment of the council, which are really matters that are outside the control of the Department of Defense and the Department of Arts and Culture, is another department. But now, what we're proposing is that, regardless of what happens, if I'm just reading that clause, we're saying despite the disestablishment of the Customs Control Board, the board must continue to operate until a council contemplated in Section 5.1 of the Cultural Institution Act has been established. So we're proposing that, and that is to make sure that once the bill has been passed, there is no vacuum. So that's why we're coming up with this transitional provision. That up until everything has been set up and that council is ready to assume the responsibility, the current Cattle Control Board will continue to fulfill this function up until that has been in place. So it's a kind of transitional arrangement that we put in place just to accommodate the kind of concerns that we're raising. The other issue that was raised here was the issue of whether the council will still be subject to the Public Audit Act and to be audited by the Auditor General. Yes, it will be there. That's why we're establishing it as a public entity in terms of Section 3A of the Public Finance Management Act. So that council, in the same way that this legal council is subject to that, it will also be subject to audits, and this house will also have the right to oversee how they manage their functions in respect of that. So that will continue, because it will be a public entity. Then there was the issue with regard to the role, first to the repeal of the act by another act, and the role of this committee in that process. I think it's conventional. I'm sitting here next to me with one of the wise guys we have in the public service from the state law advisor. Maybe he will get me out of this. Because Parliament is the legislative authority, it is part of the Capital Management Act. If you want to change anything in that respect, and if you want to do away with that legislation, it is only the same people who pass that law that can repeal it. Inasmuch as the department may want to get rid of the responsibility, but in law, which was passed by this house, if the department has that responsibility. So naturally, if you want to move out of that situation, you have to come back here and motivate why this act should be repealed. So I think that's when the committee comes in this respect, to say, this was the responsibility that was given to the Department of Defense in terms of that act. And now there is a motivation to say perhaps we need to change that situation. So the same house and the committee should assist in that process to determine whether indeed it is viable to have this kind of situation. There was a question, Chair, about the other cultural institutions, which is really a very broad question as to whether we would want to transfer all our other cultural institutions. The cultural institutions, Chair, in terms of that, are institutions that have been declared as such. But I think the Honourable Member is correct in to say that there may be other military heritage sites that we may have that we are managing as a defense force. It's a valid question as to we would like to transfer all of them to the Department of Arts and Culture. I find it to be a very difficult question for me from where I'm standing to deal with that. But I think it's a policy issue which needs to be considered. But I can't say all of them will be transferred. It depends as to what extent is the Department of Arts and Culture interested in those institutions in terms of the criteria that they have under the Cultural Institution Act, like whether those sites or those buildings will qualify as cultural institutions in terms of their criteria under the Cultural Institution Act. But I think it's a very broad question that I cannot pretend to have all the answers to. I think I've addressed the issue of the motivation behind that. I don't know if I missed any questions. I think to a large extent those were all the questions I had a good catch up. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable.
need to follow up on, I think, the question that was raised by the Honorable Minare. The way I understood this question is that we're dealing with the culture now, and then the board, you know, what was being the amendment, the repeat on that. But now the question is, don't we have similar institutions apart from this one? I'm thinking here of, like, when you get into AMCO views, is that how on the right? I think they call it the custom. Yeah, I can't remember that. But I'm now looking at the issue of qualification. You know, what the audit has actually complained about. The amount or the thing that they're talking about. Defense has got a CFO, and the CFO has got the directorate and all the data doing this. To me, they still someone, even if it's a little, but still someone must account, because this has happened under defense. Why was matter left like this? To me, these are small amounts. They don't really need highly sophisticated skills to track this. That's what I don't. Now, I'm posing this because at the same time, I am aware that this whole thing is supposed to be now managed differently. That's why, to me, the motivation for what we're doing, we must be very clear about it. We must be very, because there are people who are paid to do this job. Why is this type of thinking? I'm using this one as a sample of other institutions that are under GOG. Because now it means we must go and scrutinize exactly how are these other institutions that we manage. What are their reports saying? Because what it means to me, I would hate to see the motivation coming in a way that all in all, otherwise people are trying to run away from this type of a thing. Instead of confronting it, let's rather talk of now in the name of transformation, of changing it and bringing it other, you know, let's repeal and all so on and so forth. That's the why I'm raising it. But the other thing is, you know, to me, this side, I'm really, I'm looking also in the report. They also talk about the way of managing it for past people's tourism and all that. You see, it's nice in some of the situations seen the thing change. You give them 6 months, it's terrible. It's normal, it has lost the value, you don't even want to be associated with it. That's why, to me, it should be handy, let the also other guys come, and they must understand clearly what they are receiving. And they must be aware of this report, and they must be able to talk to us to say, to what extent are they going to be able to manage this thing? Because rather than we have to get people to manage, because what I notice is there are other people who are supposed to be appointed. Simply to appoint people to where should have been on the board. It's a simple thing that the ministry should have done. I don't understand what was holding there. There's no report that explains why the ministry was going to do that. Now the thing is that we are changing. I'm saying this very small thing, use this one as a sample, but to try and understand to what extent is DOD, is CFO, and the ministry, are they taking seriously what they are actually entrusted with the responsibility to do. And I think that you do concur with you that it will be also be of interest to know that what informs the cabinet decision. No. Because also, it shouldn't be some other shady thing. I'm not saying like that. But we must be clear. We want to just get ourselves familiarized. What informs the cabinet? Because other people, maybe they might be informed otherwise. Thank you.
Point is that I'm coming to you, Dr. Cohen. You know, the last point that the Honourable Member is raising, where an experience of a decision that was taken by cabinet, members of parliament, of the committee, should deal with that particular law, which was then prepared, because you know that there is a process of always happening in yourself before it goes to cabinet, from cabinet, then the cabinet just browse through it and then send it to parliament. Parliamentarians went through it then they ended up having it passing. Then it went to the president. But then the chair said to the president, because it was being said, when they started to look into the cabinet memo itself, they then realized that it has gone. They should have been collected there. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So that is why we tend to be very, very careful when we do this, so that we can retain these issues back to ourselves. Yes, I know that members of parliament have to retain whatever comes directly from that side, but I keep on asking, why has it to go through cabinet without being properly scrutinized? I keep on asking myself that question because I always stated that within that, those circles, with the department present, they'll be able to process something that is not going to be questionable at the end of the day, very clear. So I'm saying, you know, at times we had honor without pointing fingers. But at the end of the day, this then goes back to the same parliament is weak. It reflects on us. At the end of the day, to then say parliament is weak. I'm just doing this matter because it tends to be a concern sometimes when certain things are being processed. That is why I'm pleading and appealing that even if it's still a draft, without allowing it to go through cabinet, before it goes through cabinet, once I've been making and working on it, it's our responsibility and work, as you said earlier. We are the ones that are coming up with the rules at the end of the day. Now, it is critical then that we get the traffic in any time, so that it must then begin to inform us, accompanied by a cabinet decision that suggests that we have to make such amendments, because they are made by the department anyway, to then say what and we are proposing to cabinet that is not going to happen. Dr. Koyama.
I want to link up with what it is that you said. I feel like I'm crossing a river and I'm standing on this dirt and I know I need to jump to get to the ocean, but the next time I cannot see it. It's under the water. And that makes it very complicated because nobody, I think, and I don't think we have a problem with the content of the book. It's straightforward. It's a very simple, straightforward book. But this is not where our responsibility ends. Because if this bill is passed and we don't ask the correct questions and there is a hiccup or a comeback on asset handover, on the potential tourism facilities that are either going to be neglected or die down, or the DOD usage of the facilities. I don't know whether the DOD pays rent for the facilities currently to themselves. Is the DAC going to ask rent for the DAC in the new market related situation? It's vagueness that if there's some implication when we pass the bill as it stands, we don't have a problem there, but there are unanswered questions that I think we if we pass it and there is a comeback, they will come back not to the department, they will come back to Parliament and say you passed the new bill. Why didn't you contemplate these issues? Why didn't you contemplate that there was an improper handing over of the assets? Is it going to be an audit of the assets going to be handed over? I'm not sure. Who's going to do the audit? As far as I visited the council a couple of years ago, but I think there is a huge cultural heritage in monetary terms alone, leave alone the cultural heritage. How is any over going to be between the two departments? We currently I feel like a flying blind. I don't have a problem with the bill as it stands, but this is not where the responsibility of Parliament ends. We need to make sure that once we pass this bill, that it's a fluid handing over process between two government departments. And that DOD is comfortable with a practical arrangement, and DAC is comfortable what they're going to do.
But why is the point that was raised by Dade Munare, because I'm saying that we're having this particular board term that deals with this particular man. Are there any that should have been part of this particular board, apart from this one? We were talking of, you know, what you were then referring to. Is there a possibility that some might end up in this kind of a category? But the members would agree with me that even in the annual report, we don't hear anything about such. But we do suspect that they are there because they've indicated that they are there. But you can't find them in the annual report, or that they are also in their own board. Did we have an audit of such within the country, in the country as a whole? Do we have an audit of that? And are they directly controlled by the department, or are they also having their smaller Nyana board, like the cattle board? But that's the only one that comes to the committee, that's the cattle. Is there another one?
When you deal with the reserve, I think the reserve got so many things that we don't know about. So one day when we, when troubles emerge or problems, challenges, we will have to be on board again. So we should say, yeah, this one is agent, maybe, and one thing is no agent. Let's compare the other. But we have to say, there is no audit. When we form the South African National Federation Association in May, obviously that could be surpassed by a audit of the what is that which is the Federation Association has. It's a different question from the reserve. But the Federation, the issue of the Federation, and there are a lot of board companies, whatever they have, which we don't have the knowledge of. So it decides the issue. So this one we can concentrate on. And we can have a committee give maybe a small committee, small 2-3 people committee here, and say, let's try to go into another. Because this one is an eyewitness. That's the way. They were compelled to bring it to us because we had to retrieve it. It's an item. Because we know that there should be many other establishments which are unaccountable, which are not part of our annual report. So maybe we can deal with that issue separately and the committee such that we can get into our issue.
I think it's a real problem in the whole country, because I've been there with the public works. I know they've come up with their Giyama, and we've been also talking about those military bases. You go to Jordan, so that military base that is normally used, what is currently happening after that one, and many others. I think the former chairperson, that was Dr. Kerr, that one, did call the Department of Public Works to begin to look into that particular area on assets and asset management. I think this directly talks to us to then say, do we have, I know it will go back to Public Works, to then say, do we have an asset register that will then begin to also, it must also be incorporated in the annual report, to then begin to understand how many assets do we really have. And rather than being controlled, say to say that this one was, the cattle. No, everybody knows about it. What about the rest? So I think it's something that also when we meet with the sector, and when we meet in our coming workshop, we're going to touch on some of those issues. But if you had any last words to reflect on before we come up with a program of action.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. All the questions, issues raised by the committees are really valid, and indeed, the responsibility of this committee not just to rubber stamp and pass rush into this thing. Unfortunately, we as the delegation, we don't have all the answers that we ask. For example, whether are there other similar institutions like the CASA that need to be made visible and so forth. It's something that we will go back to the department to establish all this information, the relevant role players, so that we can give a comprehensive feedback to this committee. What is it that we have, so that we don't deal with this in 15 years. Have all the answers and come back to the committee with regard to the answers. And yes, indeed, the content of the bill are straightforward, as some of the members have indicated, but the question is what thereafter. That is the most critical thing so that we don't have the problem. So that is something also that we need to put our heads together, together with the Department of Arts and Culture, and when we come here and present a comprehensive way forward, how to manage this, to the satisfaction of the development work.
That in our program, we did come up with a program whereby we're targeting key dates, whereby we're intending that we're to pass this particular bill. Have you had to have all the clarity from both sides, DOD and Arts and Culture? We're targeting the 2026 to pass the bill. And I hear about the first, but I hear that you have accommodated that, because there is this particular structure that is in place that is going to take over. Having said that, the short notice, I know that, this is where I'm going to be very firm. I know that from the past, the departments tend to be very cagey or very sensitive when they're being called by the portfolio committee to come and present before it. We are being told that you always end up wanting for time because they have other commitments. Those issues are discussed by my office and the ministry. It's not a question that we impose. What we did is to communicate, and they came back to them and said, no, they had other engagements on specific issues. Would you then agree that, okay, fine, we'll accommodate that, and we're to shift one other item that we're intending to build? Then we then said, let's look into that bill. Let me go back to the bill. The bill has been a pressure that is coming from your side, from cabinet, to then say this bill must be passed. And they were then tabled. Now, once the bills are tabled, we have to process them. We have some time frame to meet. We have to finalize the two bills that are before us, the two, before we arrive in June. And there are the two bills that we have to deal with on or before the end of October, and are heading for election. It becomes a plus for the department when bills are passed, because it's an indication that things are happening within the department. It's me again. I'm not saying as a chairperson. You know, I've been hearing some discomforting rumors to then say, you know, the department is very late when it comes to dealing with the bills and taking off the bills, which I don't want to believe. But it's something that I have also to bring up with the inspector, because at the end of the day, because this is the end of the fifth, this is the final year, then at the same time we gauge the performance of the department over the period of time as to what have they been done. And in particular also look what bills have been put in place. Because it's a clear indication that the department is then functioning. So that is why we have to strengthen this kind of relationship. That is why we then say it's also important that you should then understand it's not a question of imposing, it's a question of responsibility that we have. That when we call upon the department, we discuss, we agree, and so that we can all meet our obligations. I'm then saying this because next to I know your department once again comes and says, no, you know, this coming up and down, pure waste and what have you. I'm saying this because we have agreed with the chairperson of the standing committee that we have to reduce what we've been complaining about in the past, whereby we find that the portfolio committee and standing committee, for the project, we then agree that we have to join forces. And when we invite you, we are all together. Not today, I invite and then he invites. So we're trying to streamline that kind of a relationship so that there must be no confusion. And then saying, it is important then that we prevail upon you to understand. We are going to be meeting with yourselves again next week regarding this one, together with the Department of Health. We request that you communicate with them accordingly to what we want to deal with this matter once and once for all, so that we can be able to address a few questions that have been raised by the members. We'll find a date, I think, between Tuesday and Wednesday. We are meeting with you on Tuesday and Wednesday this coming week. That is why it's a question of time. Where are we putting that? Could be Tuesday or Wednesday, but we will be communicating accordingly. Having said that, then, I think we have to move. Members, let's take a break for 5 minutes so that we can give it a next talk. Thanks for the presentation. We once again welcome the department on our second phase of the night. We request that the department now take us through. I don't have to repeat as can say the bill was tabled, what to detect and what to say that we want to pass this particular bill. We have an action date, as I've indicated with me, with Kirk. For the first week of May, when we come back. All the necessary procedures, public hearings and stuff, if you're going to brief we're going to follow that particular process, calling for hearings and evidence. But the last, the very first week of May, would be taking the bill. That is the second week of May, another the second. We'll be finalizing the bill during the first week of May, then tabling it on the week of the second week with us, so that we're done with both bills. Having said that, then, I'm just giving yourself that you also work with that. You should be understanding that in this process. Without any further ado, we hand over to yourself, giving us the politics behind it. The members of the having the reason for it, they said, you know what is important? We want to know the politics behind the particular life. You give us the politics, then you sit in my head with the rest. Over to you.
Thank you, the Chairperson. This presentation on the proposed amendments to the Defence Act essentially that will deal with the role and functions of the Inspector General in the DOD, also with regard to Section 65, that deals with the benefits to members of the SNGM. And lastly, to also address the issue of the reserve force, the ACOLA, during a specific period, during peacetime. Without wasting your time, also the presentation that was distributed, which will also take us through that presentation. We also have representative members from the Reserve Force and from the Inspector General Environment, who will also assist us to give us also more political issues or policy guidelines why we decided to go this route and not that route. Thank you.
Once again, thank you very much, Chairman. Like General Motor has already indicated here, we have all the relevant role players here. So mine would really just to introduce the issue, Chair, and I will allow the expert to deal with the nitty-gritties of the office. I must, however, indicate, Chair, that we we had hoped that our human resource division will be here today to deal specifically with the issue that arises from Section 55. And unfortunately, due to unforeseeable reasons, they were not able. But I will take the upon myself to present what we seek to achieve under Section 55. Then I will allow for the rest of the team to deal with the issue with regard to the reserve force. We have the Chief of the Defense Reserve, and we have a representative from the Inspector General of the Finance. But I will not deal with the issue of Section 65. What is it exactly that we seek to achieve? And hopefully I will be able to do justice to this. Chair, you will recall that we had this Defense Act of 2002, which then came into operation. But the interesting thing about this is, when the bill, the rest of the Act was brought into operation, one issue, one section that was suspended, and I will deal with the reason for the suspension of that section, was the issue of Section 55. Section 55 deals with pay and salaries and benefits of the members of the Defense Force across the board. But when we brought the Act into operation back in the day, a decision was taken that Section 55 should be suspended. And one reason for this suspension was the issue of the problems we had. I think a couple of weeks ago we discussed the issue of military labor relations in the DOD. The relationship between the union and the Defense Force or the Department of Defense had reached such a state that it was impossible to continue with any negotiations within the bargaining council. Now, Section 55 says members of the Defense Force shall receive salaries as may be agreed in the military bargaining council. But because of the nature of the relationship at the time, the minister had taken a decision to suspend the activities of the military bargaining council. One of the reasons, Chair, for that was the issue of the union at the time threatening to go on a strike for a labor unrest. And the minister at the time felt that he was not going to negotiate under those circumstances. So he insisted that the union withdraw the threat of the labor unrest and then the activities of the union of the military bargaining council can then continue. But the second issue, Chair, was the issue of pending litigation between the Department of Defense and the union at the time with regard to the issue of whether there is a duty to bargain on the part of the department with the union. Now, the view of the department until very recently was that there is no such duty in law. But the matter proceeded up until the Constitutional Court, and the Constitutional Court made some findings with regard to how we can resolve this issue. So for that reason, 1755 was suspended. And in that period, Chair, we continue operating under the old provision of Section 82B of the old Defense Act, where we allow the Minister of the PMA to make determinations with regard to salaries of the Defense Force. So in other words, whatever was determined, either in the Public Service Coordinating Bargaining Council or by the Minister of the PMA for the SMS members, who will then simply implement in the Defense Force for everybody as well. But on the 17th of May, 2004, again a decision was taken that the activities in the military bargaining council should resume. And as a consequence of that, then a decision was taken that there is no reason now to continue with the suspension. Then we brought into operation Section 55 of the Defense Act in June 2005. Now, immediately once we do that check, the provisions of that Act now have to be implemented. And one question that confronted us was that the practice in the public service in general was that salaries of senior management staff, that is people who are at level 15 upwards, are not subject to bargaining in the public service coordinating bargaining, in the public service in general. Now, there is a resolution between the unions and the Minister of PSA in this regard, where there was an argument that all those salaries will be determined by the minister, will not be subject to negotiation for level 15 upwards. Because those are senior management people. So, there's always the view that there is a conflict of interest where you have senior managers being members of the union and all that. So, for that purpose, that decision, but fortunately, given the, I suppose one would say, given the progressive nature of the unions we have at that level, it was never a problem and it was approved. But the dilemma now faces the Defense Force as to how do we determine, because in terms of Section 55, it says members of the Defense Force, it does not distinguish between members who are at level 1, 12, and the senior management. So for the first time, the Defense Force now was confronted with the question whether they should allow their senior management to be part of the union and to bargain in the Ministry of Bargaining Council. But the interesting thing was the only union in the Defense Force that is admitted to the Bargaining Council does not allow level 6 from Brigadier General upward to be members of that union. Now the question was, how do you bargain on behalf of people who are not even allowed to be members of the union in the Defense? So obviously a decision had to be taken how we are going to deal with it. And we did a lot of research and tried to compare what the public services general is doing. And one idea that came up was that we need to have a similar dispensation where we allow our ministers to make a determination for all SMS members as opposed to to subjecting them to the jurisdiction of the bargaining council. So I think by and large, I think one would say these are the policies behind CCC, to say we need to do what the rest of the public service is doing in separating the SMS from the level 12 downward. Now, Chair, what we seek to do is that members of the SMS now, which will be determined by the minister, but the practice in the public service that is level 18 upwards, will now the minister have the power in the same way as the minister of the PMA to say at the beginning of each year, this is the kind of increment if there is any, or these are the kind of extra benefits that I would like to give to the members of the SMS as opposed to the bargaining process that normally takes place in the bargaining council. Then the bargaining council's jurisdiction, therefore, will then be limited to levels 1 up to 12. That is, all those people who are in the middle management and the lower levels of the Department of Defense, they will be subject because in terms of the sanctity of the regulation, they are free to join the union. And the union allows them to join and therefore it can act on their behalf. Now, I think that basically the policy objective of the amendment to Section 65. But now, if one says the minister will do something, obviously there has to be a scientific process that informs the decision of the minister to make the determination that he will make. Now, when we look at the Department of Public Service and Administration, it's a department that has been doing this kind of work for years and for the rest of the public service. Now, the view was, if the minister has to execute this function, there surely should be some kind of an advisory body that will scientifically look at what the other defense forces are doing, and what benefits are being awarded to other ministries in the world, and then advise the minister to what will be appropriate or reasonable for him to consider for the ministry for the defense force. So now the second proposition, Chair, in respect of Section 65, is the establishment of what we have referred to as the pay review board. Now the mandate of the pay review board is broader than just pay, because they will investigate the issues of the terms and conditions in general. Then over and above that, they will deal with the issues of pay benefits and other entitlements. So we're creating this structure that should say the minister should surely be informed by some kind of a scientific process in whatever he proposes for the military. In the same way that the GPSA has the skill within itself to inform the minister of the determination. So that's the second proposition, just to say the minister should be advised. Now, I will go again to the issue of Section 10. But like I indicated, I have representatives from the IG. Like General Mono indicated, that we have what we call a defense inspectorate in the Department of Defense. But it's always difficult to determine exactly what is the scope of the powers of the IG within the Defense Force. If you look at the current provisions of the Act, there is only one section in the Defense Act that deals with the powers of the IG, and that is Section 42. We simply need that law to monitor the intelligence division. So there was a feeling that if this division is performing any other functions within the defense force, surely those functions have to be provided for in law. And that's why we're proposing to that amendment to Section 10. But for that simple, Chair, with your permission, I will hand over to General Kusi, who is from the Inspectorate General, to just take us through those. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Jay, for the opportunity. I think Mr. Michiela has already and quite very well explained the politics behind the proposed amendment. If I can just read section 42, the inspector of the current Act. The Inspector General of the Department must monitor the personnel structures of adherence to the law and procedures by and activities of the Intelligence Division. Now that is very limited and a very, very small part of what the Inspector General of the Department of Defense currently does. In fact, it is from a statutory point of view a very still impression of the activities of the Inspector General. The Inspectorate Division is an independent division falling under the Secretariat, the Secretary for Defense. And the main function is to liaise with the Auditor General and to conduct audits. Now, Chamber and members, you would know that in any State Department, and especially in the current financial climate of the state, the auditing and the inspection component of a department is very important. Especially the auditing component, which consists of two components. In the first place, it is the regulatory aspect and the performance aspect. The regulatory aspect conducts perform audits to see whether elements in the Department of Defense comply with laws and policies. Not only the intelligence division, as Section 42 contemplates currently, but all other components in the department, even in the SANDF part. The performance audit component looks at the preparedness of the forces to see whether the forces are prepared to comply with their duties, especially peacekeeping elements. Now, as you know, every inspection and every audit is an element of, I won't call it confrontation, but it's not the thing that every person would like to have, is an audit in your environment. In other words, to have a full audit, a comprehensive audit, and effective audit, you need statutory backup, statutory support, and say, you may conduct this work. And that is what Clause 10 intends to see from this committee, is the necessary statutory backup to conduct these audits. And the sole purpose is to ensure clean Audit General reports. But Section 10 also goes further, and it intends to create a function which has been established in 2004 under the Inspector General, and that is the forensic component, the anti-fraud, anti-corruption services. Once again, this directorate conducts forensic investigations, forensic audits. It has got a hotline facility where people can phone in and lay complaints. And these complaints are being dealt with. They are being investigated or referred to an appropriate component in the department. Once again, Chair, when you conduct such an audit or investigation, you need statutory support, statutory backup. People don't like it when you visit their units and you say you want to do a forensic investigation. But in the case of statutory backup and statutory enforcement, you have the necessary power to show it to an institution, say, I may do this. Parliament has authorized me to do this job. With respect to the other functions, clause 10 currently states the current functions conducted by the Inspector General. Monitor compliance with policies, conduct research to determine the effects of command and management practices, the so-called effect analysis, inspections, internal audits. A number of units must be closed down, for example, the commando units. It's an imperative of the President that it must be closed down. A new structure has been created to audit these commandos to see whether all the weapons are there, whether all the resources are there, what went missing, etc., etc. A new directorate conducts these closing down audits. And then the anti-fraud, anti-corruption services. The rest of the provisions, Chair, are only there to make an appointment for that the Minister must appoint the staff of the Defence Inspectorate. The current staff must be regarded as having been appointed in terms of Section 1. And then another important provision is that the Inspector General will not only report to the Secretary, but also to the Chief. To the Secretary with regard to audits, to the Chief with regard to the state readiness of the SANC forces. Chair, unless you have any other question, I think I shall now stop and let the proceedings continue. I don't know what is your direction in this regard.
If not, then I'll allow the members to pose questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. In order to give a complete presentation, because we are dealing with three issues here, the IG, Section 55, and that's there, therefore, I'll therefore hand over to General Anderson. Thank you, sir.
Chairperson, honourable members, thank you for the opportunity. If I could just explain that what is in the pact is what we as the Department of Defence want, but the State Board either has taken a view, which needs to be understood, to drop the section from the bill. So it's not in the bill at the moment, it was dropped on Friday. What I'd like to do is take you through the two pages of the slides in the pact before you, and then as a businessman, because as you probably all gathered, I'm a reserve force officer, I'd like to explain to you what I think we're trying to achieve in simple terms, and then it's up to the lawyers to argue as to what's the best way to achieve it. So if I may take you through just a few pages in front of us, Chairperson, it says reserve force members currently serve on a voluntary basis, that's totally voluntary, and render service in terms of a contracted period. So typically when they finish 2 years MSES, they are contracted to serve another 5 years in the reserve. Thus, members of the reserve force may only be obligated to serve during the time of war, state of national defence, or state of emergency. So you can only compel them to serve if it's war, state of national defence, or state of emergency. Furthermore, members of the reserve force have no obligation to report for training, exercises, or any deployment that falls outside a state of war, national defence, or state of emergency. This makes it extremely difficult for defence planners to plan and allocate resources as the availability of the reserve force members is not certain. To address this lacuna, it is proposed in the bill, or the bill that we put forward, that the reserve force members should, by law, be compelled to serve during peacetime under certain clearly defined circumstances. Chairperson, let me now just talk to it for a few minutes, if I may. I think it is common cause that if you have a reserve force, it must be guaranteed. Otherwise, why do you have it? It must be guaranteed to the state. And in fact, indeed, previous chairman, Professor Oshmore, instructed us as the DOD to bring forward legislation that will guarantee the call-up of a reserve. Now, we are saying, and I bear in mind I'm a reserve force officer, so I'm talking about myself in Posh. We should not only be able to call up the reserves in times of war, state of national defense, or state of emergency. There are other times when we should be able to call the reserves up. For example, for peace support operations. If I could just digress, when we deployed an next reserve force company to Sudan in June, that would be the 15th reserve force company we've deployed internally or externally since we revitalized the reserve. So it's becoming an important component. But apart from peace support operations, we say we should be able to call up reserves for international obligations. For threats to life, health, or property. Let me give you an example. During the public service strike, the reserve force units were in fact the first units to deploy during Operation Barton. 20% of the manpower in Barton was reserved. We had to transfer Scottish at Baragwana Hospital within 2.5 hours. Also, we believe we should be able to call up the reserves when the capacity of the regular force is insufficient. And we believe we should also be able to call up the reserves for training. Now, if we don't have a guaranteed reserve force, I find amongst my regular force colleagues a reluctance to invest in something that's not guaranteed. It's like paying for the insurance premium, but there's no guarantee it's going to be paid out. And in fact, one could almost argue spending money on the reserves in an environment where there's no guarantee is almost fruitless expenditure. Now, people have said, well, why do you need this? Why don't you just rely on the contract the person signs? Chairperson, it's extremely difficult and time consuming for the state to have to take each individual's contract to court individually and say you have breached your contract. And besides, what is the penalty? Now, is this something you need to know? We benchmarked the draft legislation in the following countries: Luxembourg, Netherlands, Poland, Portugal, Spain, Sweden, United Kingdom, USA, Canada, Australia, and Germany. And with minor exceptions, we found international support for what we propose. In beginning to wrap it up, let me just remind members of the committee that there are protections in the existing Act. If we call a person up and they have a genuine reason why they can't come, they either deferment and an exemption board, where they can take their case to an independent body, listen to their case, and say, we agree, you are exempted from the call-up. So there is a safeguard already in the Act. And the other question that's put is, if we make it compulsory to answer a call-up, are we in fact, is this conscription by the command? The answer is no, Jefferson, because you don't get involved in the reserves until you sign the contract. Now, all we're saying is, if you sign the contract and you committed to something, and we spent a lot of money, the state and taxpayers' money on training, then we must be assured, and the commander-in-chief and parliament must be assured, that that's a guarantee. We need a reserve force, and therefore we must be able to call it a reserve force. Let me just, in conclusion, summarize what the defense review says we need a reserve force for. The reserve force has four options. The reserve force provides the majority of the landward defense capability. The majority. So the reserve force is our conventional force. Second of all, the reserve force supplements peace support operations. Third of all, the reserve force is there to provide support to the people. Now bear in mind, correctly, we closed the commandos now. Now that the commandos are gone, who will we use in times of a national emergency? Let's assume they're flooded in the top. Or another strike, such as we had for the public service strike. The answer is the reserve force. Therefore, we must be able to call them up. And the fourth role of the reserve force is to keep certain special skills, which can't be retained in the regular force. This is particularly so in the medical, military health services, where they keep specialists on standby for emergency. So in conclusion, all we're trying to say is we want the legislation to say if you sign that contract and you receive training from us at taxpayers' expense, you must answer the call, subject to going to a deferment board who will give you exemption. Now, there's lots of complexities in the wording, etc., etc., and if I may conclude and say to the person, those wordings may need to be sorted out outside the room by the lawyer, so that a coherent answer comes forward to the committee. But our request from the DOD is a guaranteed call-up of the reserve. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
government and provide us with, and I think it is called for submission, as a department, written submission on the 7th. I'm saying this because whenever we normally a bill or an amendment are being made, you also call for something. No, I'm asking them, that's fine.
Before you make an amendment, you call for
something. Generally, we do not call for submission from the general public. We consult with the stakeholders within the department. But as a matter of principle, we don't do it for the members of the public outside.
just to clarify on the Reserve Forces issue, our stakeholder is the Reserve Forces Council, which is the body, is the statutory body in terms of the Act, look after the issues of the Reserve Forces. Not only did we consult with them, Admiral Buckett was one of the drafters with us of the bill. So we did take our major stakeholder, the Reserve Force Council, along with us in this process.
I can ask you this because I was listening to you when you said say the taxpayer's money. That's why I'm deliberate on this one. May I just say, unless you want to add this before I give to the members to know what kind of questions and comments.
Honourable Chair and members, I'm Andrew Lucas Buckett, one of the people appointed by the Minister to serve on the Reserve Force Council, which is a statutory body in terms of Section 48 of the Defence Act. The Council is a consultative and advisory body to promote and maintain the force as an integral part of the Defence Force, but there is a rider in Section 48 which says, 48.4 of the Act which says, the Council, the Reserve Force Council, must be consulted on any legislation, policy, or administrative measures affecting the Reserve Force. Now, that was carried out by the partners, General Anderson, except because the Council itself, which speaks for the reserves when it comes to these issues regarding legislation and policy, we have 10 reasons to, you know, the 9 provinces, there are 2 reasons in the Gauteng because of its size. And the Reserve Force Council stakeholders, which also represents the officer commanding the various regiments and units of both the Army, Air Force, Navy, and SAMS, were in fact consulted during this process to say, would you be prepared as a reservist affected by this particular proposed legislation to subject yourself to call-ups in times other than war? And the answer was a resounding yes. In other words, the members themselves, and General Anderson is the Chief of Defense Reserves, who himself will be subject to this legislation, has in fact agreed that that is the way to go, but there needs to be a statutory provision within the Act itself to make provision for the call-up of reserves in the circumstances mentioned. And, you know, just for the record, then the Reserve Force Council was fully involved, made an input, was party to the legislative process in terms of making the proposed amendments, and we were absolutely astounded, Chair, to find on Friday that I was advised by my learned friend, Mr. Nchikela, that 58A, which in fact addresses, and if you look at the heading of the bill, before you today, you'll find that there is in fact a reference to the obligation to serve on part of the reserve forces, that the state law advisor had in fact deleted that particular section, and our concern was simply that the process wasn't followed because we thought that the correct procedure would have been for the state law advisor to engage the DOD, where the Reserve Force Council would have been party to, for us to then discuss the points that have been raised by the state law advisor as to the reasoning why this particular section has been deleted. And we'd like to then suggest and in support of the proposal that we need to engage outside of this forum with the state law advisor, with the department's own legal advisors, with General Mono and Mr. Nchikela and the council, to debate the legal issues so that we can come forward with a consensus submission to this house for its consideration. And if we have sufficient time, Chair, by next week when you meet again, hopefully we will have some wording for you. Thank you.
I think the question was really, really about such submission, either inside or outside. Yes. the portfolio committee, love to look into those written submissions that you made. Now you are talking about the particular source that has been expanded by the particular person. And this then goes back to what we spoke about. Because these amendments have also been communicated with cabinet. So we would want really to know as to if what has been expunged was talked to by the cabinet member as a committee went to look into that. Nonetheless, I don't have to get into that now because we're getting a question from you, but we are going to, as I indicated, we should have more time to begin to interrogate on those and better call you to come and engage with us. But at this moment in time, we allow members of the Korenos
I agree with the honourable member on the issues of the reserve. But also, on our side as a committee, we need to exercise strict oversight over the reserve. We need to know what's going on within the reserve because there are a lot of things happening. But I'm not going to dwell on that. Secondly, here, a clarity-seeking question. We're talking about the subject being the council officer who has the power to inspect and investigate. But they're saying the IG in the section 43 is silent on that. Now, what's the difference? Because the death threat as a council officer, why is the power only restricted to the secretariat? because we're talking of the person who is responsible to account on the entire department. And yet, inspection and investigation is limited to the Secretariat and not the department. So I don't understand that.
Thank you very much. I've been intending to have this opportunity to explain about this. As a few contributors highlighted that we expanded it here. But the reason we did particular tools was removed, but not because of a policy issue or a legal issue here. For instance, when the member from the reserve force explained why this clause should be in here. He explained in a manner that there was a gap in the legislation regarding the deployment of the reserve force, which, according to the common law rules of interpretation, you don't legislate unnecessarily. There should be a mischief that you want to remedy, or a gap that you want to close. When we look into this particular clause that was proposed by the department chair, it states that they want to call up the reserve force in time of serious crisis. In that time of serious crisis, and they define that outside the times of war, the first 1958, they define it when the life, health, or property that is in imminent danger. And although the necessity arises to effect the, there is a list of provisions, section 18.1 of the Principal Act, that provides us with essential services that to be engaged in, and also to support any Department of State, including support for people with socio-economic assessment to effect the national border control. That is primarily what this Section 18 new clause proposes. Now, Chair, in Section 18.1, it deals with the employment of the defense force. Employment of the defense force outside the times of war, during peace time. Now, it still says that the defense force may be deployed when they fail to preserve life, health, property, emergency, or humanitarian relief operations, to provide essential services, to assist the Department of State, including support for people with social economic abatement, effect national border control. In effect, this section 58A that is proposed is proposing the same provisions that are contained in section 18.1, reportedly dealing with the regular force. Now, Chair, my argument is this, Chair, in terms of the definition of defense force and the composition of the defense force, it states that the defense force comprises of the regular force and the reserve force. So, Chair, coming to the rules of interpretation, Chair, you don't need to be unnecessary. In my view, in our submission, Chair, is that the only gap here, Chair, is the department not implementing proper particular section, Chair. Because in my legal opinion, Chair, they may implement section and deploy the reserve force using this particular section. I hear, Chair, they are saying that in 2 hours they engage in support services and all that. I'm not sure whether they did there was a proclamation by the president effective there or not. But initially, he was the proposed amendment does mention that every section 18.1 of the Republic mentioned that the president or the minister must, by provisional gazette, call out the reserve force. But the long and short of it is that is the reason that we decided to remove that 58A, that it is a key obligation of 18.1. Only means the department to implement section 18.1. It's not that the removal of it was doing away with the existence of the reserve force. But the principal aid, there are many provisions in the principal aid, Chair, are providing for the reserve force. Thank you, Chair.
Questions or comments made? I think we take that one. Thank you, Chair.
So, sorry, you just give me the two minutes. We took senior counsel's opinion, which respectfully disagreed with the state law advisor. Counsel's opinion was that we cannot rely on the reference to the regular force of the reserve force. I'm delighted to hear that there's no difference in principle. So I would like to suggest to you that it would be unfair to this house now to get involved in a legal wrangle. And perhaps Admiral Buckley's recommendation, I'm not a lawyer, I'm a simple accountant, I just know what I want to achieve, that we go back and we come back to the South in a week's time and hopefully have a consensus view on whether the Act does in fact need changing or and if so how. But there's no difference in principle, which I think is the main point. Okay.
As I said in my presentation, that the current functions that the IG does and which the Auditor General is fully aware of and also participates in that function, those functions are mentioned in the Act, in this bill. It is no new function. It's the current functions that are only stipulated. And when I answer the second question, it will come out more clearly why we seek this amendment. Or not even amendment, but further explanation, extension of the current Act. My view with respect is I don't think it was necessary to consult with the Auditor General. As I've indicated, because it's only a stating of the current existing function, which the Auditor General is fully aware of. With regard to the second question, Chair, that is a very, very, very valid question. And probably in my presentation, I neglected to refer to the other part of Section 10, the current Section 10, because that will explain also why the necessary bill should be passed. The current, you know, when the Things Act was written in 2000 and before 2000, there was a number of politics. It was the institution and the establishment of the Secretariat. In those days, it was only the National Defense Force. So the new Act established the Secretariat for Defense. And there were many political issues. And at that stage, when Section 10 was written, the politics was that each and every chief stays in his or her domain. The secretary in his domain and the chief in his domain. I repeat, there were many politics in this regard. And that's the reason why the current Section 10 says that the Secretary for Defense may instruct an employee or member to carry out an inspection or investigation within the Defense Secretariat. In other words, strictly speaking, the Inspector General could carry out his functions only in the Defense Inspectorate and not the Defense Force. But the practice was that the Inspector General should carry out his work throughout the department. And the department means the inspector, the secretariat, as well as the defense force. Now, I was also involved in the writing of this section, and it was felt that that kind of inspection should only refer to a normal departmental inspection. And I think we forgot about the inspector general's function. Maybe that the inspector general conducts audits and inspections, performance inspections, throughout the department. And that was the reason why it was decided that this further extension, which currently appears in the bill, should also be added to Section 10. That in the case of audits and forensic investigations, and closing down audits and effect analysis, that the Inspector General will be able to do it throughout the department. I must thank the Honourable Member that she raised this valid, extremely valid concern. And it also proves why this further amendment is necessary to allow the Inspector General to do his business throughout the department and not only in the Secretariat. Thank you. I've dealt with the two questions. The two questions were posed and I've dealt with them.
Honourable Chair, just to address my remarks to you, to my dear friend on my left from the stakeholder office, we certainly take cognizance of the argument that perhaps Section 18 is sufficient, but we don't want to get involved in the legal argument. I would like to refer his attention to Section 58, because there's a reciprocal, in other words, that the President can call people up, but 58, in fact, imposes an obligation on those people who have been called up to the main service. And it was really just an attempt to expand on 58, which only talks about the state of national emergency and the state of war, and to expand that into an extended 58 to make provision for operations in times other than war destructive reserves. So we would very much like an opportunity to engage with the federal advisor on the legal issues outside of this forum. Thank you.
You offered an opportunity because when we reconvene and dealing with it close by close with the partner, and would appreciate that you can understand the coming up of such outline. Dr. Colin.
Just to add on what the Honourable Zimbabwe has said, it is that if we do not have that guarantee, then we run the risk of having problems when we do budget for the reserve. That's the main problem that we will have. If we do not have this guarantee, that's the problem that we will face. Because then, somewhere between the year, the plans for the reserves will be finished and then what? That's why this is very important, this guarantee that the ownership of the honorable members to come back. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I mean, agreement of members and on the question of guarantee of our support. Now, my comment, when we say we take to that the possible be guaranteed, I look at the social welfare of the force. That should be also guaranteed, like for the salary, medical aid, pension, that they will also safeguard their lives in the process of their existence. It's very important to consider. Thank you very much.
I'm looking at the time. That's fine. Any further comments, additions? Then thereafter, I think we'll be rounding up and we should be providing you with the way forward.
So, if I may respond to the Honourable Member's last comment, as a reserve force officer, that music is my ear. But the reality is, what we give a reserve force member is trained, civilian skills, a job from time to time, studying. Only medical cover when they call up, and no pension. And the reason for that is budgetary. The reason being that you want your reserve force to be your chief option. But having said that, the Chief of Defence Force has issued instructions to the Chief of Human Resources to totally review the incentives for reserve force members and the incentives for their employers. So I'm certainly not in a position to make any promises to this committee, but I can confirm is that the Chief of Defence Force has put these issues on the agenda of the defense. But I don't predict a rapid resolution because it comes back to budgetary challenges. Bear in mind one last thing. In terms of the State of the Nation address, we are trying to, in a phased way, increase the 2-year MSA call up to 10,000. Of course, these people land up in the reserve. What we're putting a lot of effort into is finding civilian jobs for these young people. And last year we were very successful. We found 80% of the jobs. But as
as the numbers get bigger, of course, the challenge is going to get bigger for us.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I'd like to just say before you go, sir, that indeed our engagement here with the committee was quite fruitful. The issue, the guidelines given with regard to the issue of guaranteed reserve funds, after this meeting we will engage our colleague from the Central Advisor to prepare them. And also those questions that were raised that we couldn't respond immediately, how many other institutions similar to cash management we have within the department will also come back with a response to that. And then the department could also in our intent to finalize testing of this bills. We will be ready for any call any time. We are taking note of the concerns raised by the portfolio commission on defense that it's in our interest that it's ready. And those who are not here will also engage them, will give them to our ministry, to our secretary for defense to take note of this. We will come better prepared next time. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Chair. That's a I hear what the committee is recommending, Chair, that I should engage with the department on this legal issue, Chair. And I also noted that the committee wants a guarantee for the reserve force to be included in the budget, Chair. However, that's why to place on record, Chair, that it seems that the question of implementation here, Chair, if the department or defense does not give the reserve force as part of the NDF, in budgetary issues, Chair, I think there is an anomaly, Chair. Because if they separate it, Chair, when they make a budget, they take only the reserve force and neglect the reserve force, Chair, which is part of the reserve force, in terms of the principal act, Chair, then I think we have a problem, Chair. That's why to the community knows that, Chair. Because it is a guarantee present. For the regular force, then automatically it will be a self guarantee also for the reserve force, because it is part of the defense force. I would like to sit down on that issue. Thank you.
I
think that
we may because we also want to make an effort because there can be no separation of the two. I think the budget must be one. To the economist, I think we would agree as far as that one is concerned, because we cannot have two separate budgets for one. There's only one force. So that would be our strength and our emphasis on that particular one, because we have to begin to clear it, so that we clear up any confusion that may arise. But having said that, I take this opportunity to thank you for coming and for finding one another. Because one is critically important to begin to understand one another and commit ourselves to achieving the objective. And in so doing, because there's one thing that I don't like, is where there is some form of antagonism. What is critical is to say, let's achieve the given objective. Because what you have done to come up with this particular goal is part of the responsibility and obligation. So it is easy for us then to get very close. And communicate. It's even as it said that at 12 midnight, if you saw me, feel free to communicate. You may have a problem. But if you're not communicating, we look into it. Don't shy away. That's what I'm saying. Even from the state law advisor, if there is something that he intends to raise with us, because we like to engage on this issue, it's not for us, it's for the nation at the end of the day. We have a national agenda that we should achieve. This also talks directly then to the performance of the department. We pride ourselves as committee members to working very closely and being oversight over the department. Because at the end of the day, we also want to tell the electorate that this is actual matter. That's why we're saying the question of public hearing. You remember that I made a comment about key activities that are taking place without the portfolio committee knowing, which are very crucial in this one, because the nation must know. You know, Sam, I keep on priding myself when I see these things happening on TV, but as a chairperson, I end up asking, how much, by the way, do I know about that? Because I heard about it. The issue of the portfolio.
but it was just something very new to hear about. From a foreign like that. You get what I'm saying? Just from a foreign to come and tell us about that. And only to find that members of parliament do not know a thing about it. What about our country government? Because it's an exciting exercise that is taking place. That can stimulate our young to begin to understand and know what is happening. Because we're shaping our interests. So I'm not just saying this to you. We are going to meet with the SecDef once again and begin to engage on this.